Have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? The great thing about podcasts is that you don't have to be a professional to do it. Anybody can publish anything. But there are a lot of questions to ask when you first get started. I know I had a bunch. How do I record an episode? How do I get my show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all the other big places people like to listen? And how do I make money off my podcast? Because it truly is a labor of love. To answer every one of these questions, it's really simple, actually. Anchor. Anchor is a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing your podcast. Best of all, it's 100% free and ridiculously easy to use. Even I can use it. And now Anchor can match you with great sponsors too, so you can get paid to podcast. I love Anchor because it's simple to use. I can record an episode or just a thought on my phone and upload it right then and there. They provide background music and also some sounds to really make your podcast pop. So if you've ever wanted to start a podcast and make money doing it, go to anchor.fm/start. To join me and the diverse community of podcasters already using Anchor, that's anchor.fm/start. I can't wait to hear your podcast. Welcome to the Your Oxygen Mask First podcast. I'm Erin Young, and this is the space where we explore ways to help the helpers. Because you can't help anyone before you help yourself. So sit back, put your own oxygen mask on, and enjoy the ride. Thanks again for joining us, and I am so excited to be continuing our deep dive series on suicide prevention for veterans. And today I'm honored to be joined by Dr. Ryan Stevenson. Dr. Stevenson has spent many years helping others get through trauma by using techniques on the cutting edge of psychology. He now provides therapy to veterans, students, victims of trauma and sexual assault at California State University, San Marcos. Thank you, Ryan, so much for joining us.
You bet. It's an honor to be here. Thank you so much.
So briefly tell us about yourself, some personal history, why you chose psychology.
Okay. Yeah, so I grew up in Utah in the Salt Lake City area. My dad was in the Army for 9 years, and that was prior to me being born. I have a large family. I also have a brother who's in the Utah National Guard. I am not a veteran, but you know, some of that military culture did influence my family. But yeah, over the years, I really loved outdoor things. I played soccer competitively, skied and snowboarded and camped, mountain biked and things like that. Just traveled a little bit. Also in college, I did some study abroads. And so it's really, I value learning and growing and have a great sense of curiosity. So I think that also overlaps with my interest in psychology. And the reason I got into psychology is I wanted to be a teacher and a soccer coach, but my freshman year of college, I had gotten a little bit of trouble with, you know, alcohol and marijuana and things like that when I was in high school. Not a lot, but to my parents, it was problematic. So they made me go to therapy. It turned into a really positive experience. My family actually all went to family therapy. I really loved it. And so right away, I just thought, you know, I liked my psychology class in high school. And I learned a lot from this experience. It helped me get closer with my family and understand myself and relationships better. And so I, from right away, freshman year, I said, I want to be a therapist. And I really wanted to work with couples and families. And so my track was marriage family therapy. And I stuck with that. And like I said, I did some study abroads. I was able to do some therapy in South Africa. Mm. Well, yeah, with one of my internships there, working in a community mental health clinic. And that was in 2002. So I've been doing therapy for about 16 years now. I always thought I could never get a PhD. I've never felt really confident about writing. And I just thought, yeah, that dissertation thing just sounds way too hard for me. So I thought, well, I'll just get a master's degree. I was on that MFT track for my whole undergrad until a friend of mine we were doing the same thing. And he said, oh, we should look into social work. And so I changed my mind. I'll get into this a little bit later, but something funny is that I thought during undergrad, oh, I could never be a social worker. They just deal with all the hard stuff like child abuse and domestic violence and trauma. And like, that's too much for me. I don't want to do that. I could never do that. But I did change my mind and I did an MSW for various reasons. And I'm really glad I did. I'll never regret that choice. It was a great experience, great training, and just so broad in general. So at the end of my 2 years of my MSW, I was offered a job in St. George, Utah, the southwest corner by Zions National Park, doing mostly domestic violence and substance abuse work. I took it and I ended up loving it. So I was just working on my 2 years of hours, and the economy tanked at that time in 2008. I had thought about going back to school, and a mentor had said, hey, I think you could really do this. So I looked around, and I didn't want to do clinical psychology because it was so pathologizing in my mind and is really competitive. So I went with counseling psychology because it had a stronger focus on social justice and multicultural competence. So I did that, and I got my counseling psychology, my PhD. You know, over the years, I've worked in community mental health. I've worked at a rape crisis center in Salt Lake City. I worked 2 years at the Salt Lake City VA on their PTSD clinical team, which really, that really opened my eyes to trauma and PTSD in a bigger way, and especially working with veterans and the men and women who were in our military service. And I really, really loved that. And a lot of my friends and colleagues were going into a VA track. So I wanted to do the VA, but I didn't get accepted for an official APA accredited internship. And I went through the University Counseling Center route, and I went to UC Santa Barbara for internship and UC San Diego for postdoc, and stayed pretty connected to working with student veterans. And then over the years I worked, my recent job prior to working at Cal State San Marcos was at the VA in their telemental health clinic. It wasn't a good fit for me. I can talk about that more later, but I loved working with the veterans. I just struggled to work in that environment that's so kind of rigid, and the bureaucracy at the VA is pretty rough. So that took me back to counseling centers, but I really focus and emphasize on working with student veterans and attend a lot of their meetings and try to create programming so that the student veterans and their dependents can utilize services. And I also spent 14 months working on a study where I was the prolonged exposure therapist. And we were comparing prolonged exposure with transcendental meditation. And so my job was just to do prolonged exposure with veterans that qualified for the study. And I was on the very back end of the study. Really fascinating and great experience. I got to be really good at prolonged exposure and enjoyed working with the veteran participants. So yeah, I've worked on campuses and I've worked with veteran populations off and on for the last probably 7-8 years directly. And I've been licensed as a psychologist in California for 3 years now. And so, yeah, that's kind of a brief history.
Well, that's very impressive. And I appreciate the fact that you're coming from a place where you had challenges and difficulties growing up, and you were able to channel that into bettering yourself and helping other people, because you don't see that too often. Or if you do, people don't actually talk about their past struggles and how they got there.
Yeah, I think it's really important. I'll often tell clients that is, you know, the reason I'm sitting in this chair is because I, excuse me, I went to therapy and it was helpful and I really enjoyed it. And I've gone over the years, you know, for different reasons. But the fact that I went because of, you know, getting into trouble and that I had to go, and usually people who have to go to therapy don't enjoy it. From the outset, and hopefully that changes. And I've seen that a lot with, like, you know, domestic violence and substance abuse treatment, where people don't really want to be there. And I will acknowledge that and say, yeah, I don't think any of us want to be here, but let's see what we can get out of this experience. And it's turned into some really positive opportunities for the client and myself. And yeah.
And my hope too is that we change the stigma or surrounding therapy altogether, and that it becomes as regular as, you know, going and getting a haircut or any of those other self-care things that we make a priority for and we make appointments for. It should be normal, just like that.
I couldn't agree more. I that's what I say all the time. Like, I really, my wife always teases me because I like therapy a lot. And I think anyone could really benefit. And I also really like sports psychology and performance psychology. So whether you're really, like, struggling with depression or something really severe, like, you can always improve yourself and gain greater self-awareness. And like you said, self-care is so important. We all have really stressful lives, and it's a place to just go and talk to somebody that doesn't know you. They're not your friend or a family member, and you can really just open up and work on things small or big. So I think I'm glad to see the stigma changing, but there's still a lot of work to be done, especially with boys and men. There's a lot of stigma around getting help. And that's one area that I've focused on in my studies. I joined a division of the American Psychological Association. It's called Division 51, and they just focus on clinical issues related to boys and men. So that's been a big emphasis of mine.
Oh, wow. I didn't even know that that existed. So that's good to know.
Yeah, there's all sorts of cool divisions in APA and, you know, the LGBT population, trauma, girls and women. And so, yeah, that's a nice area to kind of focus on.
Yeah, I have to hit you up on the sports psychology stuff later. I have two competitive gymnasts.
Awesome. Yeah, it's exciting stuff.
We could do another whole podcast topic on that.
Anytime.
Okay.
Anytime.
So you talked briefly about your history. Is there anything you want to speak about your accomplishments or challenges that you faced living in the world of psychology?
Yeah, I think that's a great question because it is hard. I mean, on one hand, I think, oh, there's a lot of psychologists out there and there's a lot of people with PhDs. And as I mentioned earlier, I just never thought I could do it. I had relatives. I have an uncle who has a PhD and my dad has a master's and a brother who had a master's. And I just thought, I can't do that. I'm not a good writer. And I think with how it relates to trauma is that fears get the better of us. And we just don't think we can like push through those fears. But by continuing to just expose ourselves and push, that's how we get over all sorts of fears. And we learn from childhood into adulthood is, it's scary to drive a car, but we do it over and over and over and it becomes easy. So I think getting my PhD and my dissertation was like 200 pages total. It was like a beast. That was a big accomplishment and something I'm, you know, really proud of. I also helped a friend defend their dissertation on Friday. She had a reader on her dissertation committee had dropped out. And so she asked me at the last minute, but it was really a great experience to help her. And it was just myself and her chair that, you know, graded her on it and passed her. So just another small accomplishment. But my degrees and, you know, the places that I've worked, I think working at the VA in and of itself at this level is kind of an accomplishment. But in addition to that, some of the challenges I've faced is that, you know, I go through school. I've changed my jobs a lot because of financial, you know, implications or going back to school and student loans and things like that. And at the very end of, I did my internship and I graduated and then I went down to UCSD to do my postdoc and I did my postdoc and I took the two licensing exams that are really challenging. And I took my last exam, the California licensing exam, right when I finished my postdoc and I was ready to start my career and I didn't obtain a job. I thought a job would be out there, you know, and whether it was somewhere within the military, a contract job or the VA or a university counseling center. And I was unemployed for 5 months.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, my wife and I thought, well, we did all this work and you got this PhD and we thought this would be financially lucrative and all this stuff. And, you know, I was unemployed and a lot of people face unemployment, especially in the last, you know, 10 years, but that was tough. That was really hard. And living in an area where it's really competitive, the VA in San Diego is hard to get a job at. And so it's just, we wanted to live here because this is where my wife's from and our kids were kind of established. And so that was tough. And I've changed jobs quite a few times in the last 4 years, but I try to be an optimist and I've learned a lot from each opportunity. And the VA wasn't a good fit. I thought all these, you know, for years, this is going to be my dream job. And my friends are working at the VA in other states. And it really wasn't what I thought it was going to be. So I feel like I've finally found a place where it feels like a good fit and a job where I can make a difference and I can reach out to the veteran community and establish relationships and kind of build from there. So it's been a rough road, but I've learned a lot. And I think it's helped me be more versatile and a better generalist in the work that I do.
Mm-hmm. Able to connect a little bit better to people who've had similar experiences.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. For sure. Yeah. People who've been through struggles or lost their jobs or had to move and family stuff. And so, yeah, it I think it definitely helps relate and empathize with others for sure. Mm-hmm.
So with your work, I've been told that you are on the up and up of some of the more recently used modalities of therapy. What are some of the exciting therapies and breakthroughs that you've been exposed to in your line of work recently?
Well, I would say that I'm just going to go back briefly to give some context. I have worked with trauma survivors for years, and it was just kind of a more generalist social work approach, and I didn't know any like evidence-based treatments. And so my training at the Salt Lake VA exposed me to prolonged exposure and cognitive processing therapy and really diagnosing, evaluating, and assessing trauma and PTSD. And that gave me a really strong foundation. And so I don't know if I'll ever call myself an expert, but I would say an area that I focus on and a specialty of mine is trauma. And I can safely say that that covers the broad range of sexual trauma for men and women, boys and girls, domestic violence, abusive relationships, accidents, natural disasters, and definitely combat trauma. And so, you know, over the years and working with different populations and working with veteran populations, I've come to learn what the current evidence-based treatments are. And I really love PE, and I'm better at that than cognitive processing therapy, but they're both really great treatments. And I've seen veterans and survivors really take to it and learn a lot of skills. And I like to use that word kind of to help people connect with it and not see it as like a mental health or a negative thing, but like these, we're just giving you more tools. You learned all these tools and skills in the military or in your line of work in law enforcement, and they've served you, but now we need to, you know, add some tools to that to help you perform better and cope with what you've gone through. So I feel like I have a pretty good understanding of what trauma and PTSD is, and how that's defined clinically and what that looks like in everyday life. And now I've been exposed to some really amazing breakthrough treatments using psychedelics and other medicines. I've always been kind of open to the idea and the concept of healing through different modalities and means. And there are so many out there, you know, yoga and surfing and outdoor activities, which I love. And I think that as long as people can take advantage of things that they enjoy or push themselves outside of their comfort zones and try something that helps them heal and become a whole person, that's really important. So a friend and colleague of mine that I worked with a couple of years ago introduced me to MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. And they are doing some amazing work. And there are other groups and organizations out there that are also, basically, it's not new. These therapies that were done back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and until Nixon and the DEA deemed these drugs Schedule One, not able to be researched or used for any purpose, they were used therapeutically and used very well to treat all sorts of things. But so what happened was this friend said, hey, you know, we could go through this training. They're looking for mental health professionals like ourselves who want to be adherence raters for this study that they're doing. They're trying to get FDA approval for MDMA assisted psychotherapy for PTSD. And I thought, well, that sounds interesting. And he told me about it and I kind of put it on the back burner. I thought, wow, that sounds fascinating. That's really cool, but I'm just so busy. But 6 months later, that's when he came to me and said, hey, we could do this training. And I said, all right, well, I've got time now. I'm interested. So we went through a process of about 6 to 8 months of meetings, trainings, and watching a lot of videos. And basically, MAPS is starting their phase 3 trial that's been approved by the FDA. They've had really amazing results from phase 1 and phase 2, like astounding results, because prolonged exposure and CPT, they have some good outcomes, but about 50% on average drop out early from these treatments, because with PTSD, avoidance is such a huge part of it. And people, once they start getting into looking at the trauma itself, it's so difficult and so challenging and so overwhelming emotionally, cognitively, and physiologically that they just can't continue to process it. It's difficult work. And so people just don't want to do it, or they don't feel up to it, or it's just too challenging.
And Ryan, sorry to interject, but the prolonged exposure, is that where they tell their story or their trauma over and over again, or is that something else?
No, you got it exactly right. Yeah, prolonged exposure, you're spending 20 to 40 minutes of closing your eyes and talking about from start to finish the most difficult part of your trauma. And it's powerful and it's effective, and you habituate to the experience and you overcome it, but that's hard work.
And how do people not do that with alcohol? I don't understand.
Yeah. I mean, we have so many coping mechanisms, and that's why, you know, a lot of people turn to substances and other things, and avoidance just in general, any way to avoid. That's a huge part of trauma and PTSD, is avoiding the reminders, because it feels really overwhelming. And it feels like if I think about that or talk about it, it will never go away. And that's actually not the case. You know, theoretically, if you got to look at it, you got to talk about it, and you got to process it to get it to go away. It's kind of like just putting a Band-Aid on like an infection. You know, you got to really get in there and clean it out. And, you know, there's all sorts of amazing analogies, but that work is hard. Cognitive processing therapy, you don't spend the amount of time like going over the details, but you, in one form of the treatment, you write down all the details of the trauma. But the good news is through recent research, they found that clients don't have to write the details of the trauma. They can just talk about the surrounding kind of thoughts and beliefs that have come out of the trauma itself and have a lot of the same effect. So that's great to see that, you know, people don't have to go into all the details of it using cognitive processing therapy, but they're different kind of theoretical rationales, and they're both can be pretty effective. And a lot of people have found a lot of help and healing from those things, but they're just really tough to do. And a lot of people don't even want to try it because it sounds and looks really hard. Mm-hmm.
And how do the psychedelics play into that?
So the beauty is, and this might sound really biased, and I just want to say this, I've never used MDMA. I don't know what it feels like to be on that drug or that medicine. But what I do know, and what research and anecdotal evidence is showing, is that, and we have brain scans to show this, it's really amazing. And I've just, because I enjoyed trauma work, and that's kind of my passion, I've done a lot of this extra research. And there's a great book out there, Michael Pollan's book on How to Change Your Mind is amazing. It just, you know, you take somebody who's so kind of trusted out there in journalism in certain circles, and he brings to light this work that's going on. However, he doesn't spend much time talking about MDMA, or, you know, what other people know on the streets is, you know, ecstasy, but MDMA is the pure form of the drug. But MDMA is an amazing substance, because what it does is it reduces the response in the amygdala, where all the fear comes up for us emotionally. So it kind of, it dampens that fear response. So people feel safe, they feel warm, they feel compassion, they feel connected to others. And if you're processing trauma with another person, that's really powerful to feel connected to somebody else and to not have that fear response. So they can talk about the traumas in great detail and feeling like a sense of like calm, compassion, and even maybe some confidence that there's a different perspective and that fear isn't present. So it's like, in some ways, it's like this drug was made specifically to treat trauma in the right circumstances. And this isn't like, you know, traditional psychiatry where, you know, take this pill, go home, and, you know, hopefully that will help your neurochemistry. This is reducing that neurochemical experience. It increases serotonin, which makes you feel positive and connected and all those things. And so for 8 hours, the participant is on this medicine, sitting down with two therapists, usually it's a male and female co-therapist team, and they're trained in this approach, they're trained clinicians, and they almost don't even, the therapist almost don't even have to bring up the trauma, it'll just naturally come up. And they use some really interesting words like your inner healing intelligence, and that might sound kind of woo-woo and like hippie out there, but it's true, we all have intuition, and we all know ourselves better than anyone else. And so a lot of the time in this therapy, they'll put on blindfold or like a mask, an eye mask, and listen to music, and the medicine will just kind of help them process things internally. But then they'll take the eye mask off and they'll talk to the therapist for hours about, you know, what happened and what do they think about it now and looking back on it. And it really helps people correct some of those negative schemas or narratives that they've been telling themselves for all these years. And it just helps them feel like they can overcome this thing and that it doesn't define their whole life. So it's It's pretty amazing. And that's just one of the treatments, but that's the one I'm most familiar with because I went through that training and now I'm currently a rater, an adherence rater. And my job is just to watch these videos and look over the protocol and the list of things that they're supposed to address for, you know, ensuring safety and proper education of the participant, making sure they're doing a good job clinically. I never thought of myself as a researcher. I always thought of myself as a clinician and a therapist. But working at Veterans Medical Research Foundation with that prolonged exposure trial or comparison study, and then this, I feel like I really want to help the field grow and find treatments that are helpful for people. And you can only imagine if they're overcoming PTSD that the rates of suicide and depression are also going to go down if you feel this new sense of healing and being a different person and overcoming these huge hurdles in your life gives you a whole new sense of meaning as you move forward.
Well, that is amazing. When you said psychedelics, I'm thinking about a guy on shrooms laying on a therapist's couch, kind of tripping out, but it's completely different.
Well, actually, you're not wrong there. Oh. You're not wrong. So MDMA is, you know, that's, they don't even consider it a traditional psychedelic. You're not like hallucinating and things like that. You're just feeling a lot of emotions and feeling really good and connected to people. But yes, there are therapies out there for sure that are showing great outcomes for like depression. So with magic mushrooms or psilocybin, a client will take that in the morning and they'll do about a similar thing, 6 to 8 hours of laying on a couch or a bed with a therapist or two therapists. And a lot of the times it is an internal process with psilocybin, but there is also a lot of talk therapy connected to it. And there's videos online. I mean, YouTube. One thing I would say is, you know, anytime you put in MAPS, M-A-P-S and MDMA, you'll get some, they're a great organization. And like I said, FDA has fast-tracked their studies because they've been so effective. And it's likely that MDMA will become legal for medicinal uses in the next year or two because of this research. But the use of psilocybin and LSD are also, when used in the right context therapeutically, they can be profoundly helpful in healing things like depression. Even with just one day of therapy, people can be free of depression for up to a month. So these are really breakthrough, and the psychiatric community and the psychological community are really, they're paying attention, and this research is being approved. It's being done all over the US and in other countries like the UK and the Netherlands and Israel. And so there's a lot of great things that are being done, but I really couldn't say too many positive things about MAPS. They're doing other studies too, besides just MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for PTSD. So other things that are helping veterans as well. Also dealing with the opioid epidemic. So that's another huge issue that veterans and people dealing with mental health issues are struggling with. So
it just goes to show that there is value to thinking outside of the traditional norm and the box, and that I know people that would pay anything, do anything, go through anything to make the pain go away. So why not try anything possible?
Yeah, right. I was just talking with a friend who's just struggled with depression. It's a father of my friend that I've known since childhood, and just so desperate when you're dealing with depression for decades and trying so many different kind of medications, even like breakthrough kind of alternative stuff. Like people are using ketamine now for depression, and that works. It's working really well for some, and it's not working for others. And that's one thing that's really important is, you know, some things work for some people and don't work for others. And so it's nice that we have all these different tools that can be used in the next 5 to 10 years. It won't be shocking to see clinics where these different alternative medicines or drugs that we see as bad now as like normal, very effective treatments in the future. It's really exciting. They're calling it the psychedelic renaissance. And so it's pretty powerful. I just finished listening to all of Michael Pollan's book, and it's really amazing. He does a good job of hitting on all the research and the history and the who's who and what do these things do. And he even does some of it himself because he really wanted to see what it was like. So I really can't recommend that book more highly. And another book that I would throw out there, especially for veterans, is a book called Acid Test. It's kind of an interesting name, but it takes a Marine who has pretty severe PTSD, and it walks him and the therapist and the guy who started MAPS, Rick Doblin, and it just kind of tells their stories and their histories and how important this treatment is. And so that's a fascinating book too, just to kind of see how Nick Blackstone goes through, he's the Marine who goes through this treatment, and the kind of how this therapy emerged, and it kind of tells the story behind the study that I'm a part of. So it's a great one that I highly recommend.
Absolutely. And I'll link to it in our resources page and on your page on my website.
Cool.
So talking about mental health, suicide, what is one thing you wish everyone knew about mental health and suicide?
I think something that's helpful for people to know is that, one, it's okay to talk about suicide. There's that myth and the incorrect idea that if I bring up the idea, that might tip somebody off and they might go and commit suicide. Well, the reality is, if they're already thinking about suicide, you're not going to make it worse by asking about it or talking about it. And that, I think mental health is just, it's this thing where very black and white a lot of times in our thinking, and it's like either you have it or you don't. And mental health is just like our health. We all deal with ups and downs of our mood. We all experience anxiety. We all experience low emotions and some of the symptoms of depression. And a good number of us will have these things to the level that it will turn into what we call a disorder, or it will impair our functioning so much that it makes it difficult. And so it's just important, like you were saying earlier, that the stigma changes and that we see it in a different light, and that the more that we're open to it and getting people help, the better we'll be. We won't run from it. We won't see it as a weakness. You know, we all get hurt. We all get sick. We all can get, you know, sick in an emotional or a mental way. And we've all gone through so many things. We've all experienced some kind of a trauma in our life. I like to think of trauma as small T traumas and big T traumas. And I'll talk about that in our next question. But suicide, another thing I'll tell clients a lot of the times is that it's normal to have thoughts of, boy, I wish I just didn't wake up tomorrow. I mean, any of us, when we've been really overwhelmed or something really bad's happened, that thought goes through our mind of, I wish I could just not have to deal with this. And that's close to suicidal thoughts of like, I wish I just didn't wake up tomorrow. I wish this could all go away. And that's a huge part of suicidal thinking is, this is so much. I don't like this. And of course, on this spectrum, it gets worse as those thoughts continue to stick around and hang around. And then we start thinking about them more. And usually that's associated with the feelings of hopelessness and, you know, a lot of depression and severe depression. And so I would just want everyone to know that having those thoughts are normal, or even the thought of like, I wish I could die, or I don't want to be alive anymore. And that's real. And that's normal. And there is help. You know, people who do feel these things can get better. I mean, I just spent minutes, a long chunk of time saying, when you've gone through trauma or you have post-traumatic stress, you have, you know, depression, moderate to severe depression, a lot of times you feel hopeless and you feel like it's never going to get better. And our thinking gets more weighed down. And we know from research and anecdotally that people who are depressed get more stuck in these negative thinking ruts. And so it just kind of builds, and it's hard to see the light at the end of the tunnel as these things get worse and worse, and just keep building, and you start thinking about it more and making plans, and then your desire to live kind of starts to shift to, I'd rather die than live. And that's this spectrum, and it's important to get help. And there are therapies and there are medicines and drugs even that can help with that. And so I just hope that people recognize mental health and taking care of ourselves in so many ways, and being a whole person means so many things, and just changing that stigma, and that there is help out there, and that we can talk about these things without it doesn't harm people to talk about suicide. It doesn't increase their likelihood that they're going to go and kill themselves. And that when people do kill themselves, a lot of family members and friends have those doubts, you know, I should have done more, and why didn't I do this, and all the hindsight thinking. And that's really important to get help for, because we can overly blame ourselves for something that I truly believe we do the best we can in the moment. You know, given four decisions, we usually make the one that feels like the best decision in the moment. And then when we look back on it, we just have that Monday morning quarterback of I coulda, shoulda, woulda, but I believe we did the best we could in the moment. So I've worked with a lot of people or talked to people in the last few months about whether it's family member or friend, like that lost somebody to suicide. And it's normal to have those thoughts, but it's helpful to kind of get those processed and talked about in a more healthy way with whether it's a friend or a professional. So. Mm-hmm.
And what about the average person? What should they know about PTSD and trauma?
I will say this, PTSD, the diagnosis is very complex. There isn't another disorder in the DSM that has more criteria that I can think of, except for like schizophrenia maybe. But to have PTSD, you have to have like a core experience of close to death, thought I was going to die, or a very significant interpersonal trauma like rape or sexual assault. And then there's all these other criteria under that. And so it's just really complex and it looks different for people. And it's often portrayed incorrectly or not very well in, you know, TVs, movies, but it is really complex. And to have that diagnosis, you have to meet a lot of criteria to have the diagnosis. But trauma, like I was saying earlier, happens to all of us at some point in our life. We've all, by the time we die, we've had something rough happen to us, whether it's a natural disaster or an accident or a moment where you almost died or you almost were severely injured or you were injured. And then there's all the little T traumas of interpersonal things, abuse, neglect. I mean, if 1 in 4 girls and women have experienced sexual violence and 1 in 6, and those are just reportable, there's a good chance we've all had some pretty rough sexual trauma in our life, or bullying, or psychological or emotional abuse, and all those things kind of pile up. And the thing that I think is important to know with trauma is that it does change our sense of trust, safety, self-esteem, sense of intimacy with others, and a feeling of power and control. Those are the kind of the 5 areas of trauma that might be impacted, especially in an interpersonal trauma when somebody's done something to harm us. So it really shifts the way we view ourselves and others. And it doesn't mean that if you've experienced a trauma, you will develop enough of the symptoms to meet the diagnosis of PTSD. Most people heal naturally over time, and that's a good thing. But where PTSD usually becomes a problem is that it doesn't naturally get better on its own for lots of reasons, but one of those is avoidance. People avoiding the reminders or avoiding working on it or talking about it or thinking about it in a healthy way. And so it just never gets better. And that's one view, one rationale, one explanation for why people end up having PTSD is that, you know, why do some people go to war and they see a bunch of stuff and they come home and they don't seem to struggle or have the same number of symptoms or severity of symptoms as somebody else who just had one thing happen to them? You know, that's kind of complex and tricky, but there's all sorts of risk factors and we don't know people's prior history. And that's something that, you know, researchers look into is all these risk factors, but trauma affects a lot of us. And the more that we experience, there's a greater chance it can have significant impacts on our life.
And especially, I don't know how you feel about vicarious trauma, but as a 911 dispatcher, I deal with everybody's worst day of their life for 10 hours a day, 4 days a week for 14 years. So is there validity to that kind of PTSD?
Oh, most definitely. I mean, the work that you do is very challenging. You know, in my field, I hear a lot like, you know, secondary trauma for therapists. You know, they're always talking about it at the VA and secondary trauma for over and over and over talking to trauma survivors. You're hearing all these gory details. You're hearing it firsthand. I can't even imagine. That sounds like such a hard job. To my mind, I always think I would never want to be an ER doctor and I would not want to be a first responder. I mean, I deal with people coming in on crisis, and I guess I've learned how to deal with that in a mental health field. But yes, for sure, you're hearing people's worst days. You're hearing scary things, stressful, really harsh things. And that does have an effect on us. I mean, we're human beings. How could that not impact us? And so even like the vet centers, if somebody, like they only serve veterans who were deployed or experienced military sexual trauma, but now they've started opening it up to people who are drone pilots or first responders that are hearing really difficult details over and over and over. That's almost like experiencing the trauma itself. Our brain doesn't really distinguish between, did I really live it or did I like watch it on TV? So, or did somebody screaming and crying into the phone, like that's traumatic. So yeah, those things are, that adds up, and we need to take care of ourselves. I imagine in your line of work, people talk about self-care a lot and they talk about that over and over in the mental health field, because we're being exposed every day to human suffering, and that has an impact.
And that perfectly segues into my next question. What does the average person like me, what can I do to better my mental health?
You know, there's a lot of things, and I think just some of the core, I've learned in the last few years how important sleep is, and sleep experts talk about how important that is, and trying to get 7 or 8 hours for the average person, that's huge. Sleep deprivation has so many implications, but good sleep, good diet, nutrition. There's so many studies that show, you know, eating processed foods versus, you know, natural foods. There's a difference there. You think about the things that are fueling our neurochemistry in our brain. You want sleep. You want good eating habits. Exercise has a great influence on how well we do, and being resilient in managing the stressors in our life. I think another important cognitive thing is giving ourselves permission to be more self-compassionate. There's a lot of research that shows self-compassion is so important and is almost a better motivator than like the drill sergeant, like, you know, get down there, work hard, pump it out. Like self-compassion can be a better motivator, and it's so much better for our well-being mentally, emotionally. And just changing the stigma, changing, again, giving ourselves permission to go and schedule that appointment with a therapist, like we're scheduling a nail appointment or a massage or, you know, going on a vacation, just accepting that as being normal, and that it's not just crazy people that go to get help. We all have our things, and we need to take care of ourselves. And I think in our culture, it's viewed as being weak to view these things in these ways. And I really don't think so. I think it makes us stronger, and it makes us better emotionally with partners and families and others, just to be more. And I think a lot of this is for men that we're just socialized that this is not okay, and that the sign of weakness, but it's not. It makes us more well-rounded, and we'll live longer and live happier lives if we attend to these things.
Absolutely.
And things like, yeah, yoga and mindfulness and fun activities, taking breaks, taking your vacation time. I mean, we work really hard, and that's great, but we do need to take a break and do other things and enjoy ourselves and value and give permission for our mental health to be a significant part of our life.
That is exactly what I like to hear. Go fishing.
Yes, definitely.
And we talked about it a little bit, but is there any other advice you want to give someone who's on the fence about getting help?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of reasons why people might be on the fence. And like, first off, if you had a bad experience with help or therapy or mental health, especially if you did it as a teenager, you were forced to go, like, give it another try. Research shows that if you find a good fit or a good connection with your therapist, that's the most important thing. So kind of do your research or try to find somebody that you feel like is a good fit for you. And if you don't like who you're working with, try somebody else. That's the number one most important thing, is like connecting with your therapist, trying different things. Group therapy is scary. It's so scary, and we're afraid we're going to have to be really vulnerable, but most groups you don't have to be. There's very few therapy groups where you really have to tell a lot about yourself. And those kind of groups, you're going to know that before you do it, because you're going to have a lot of pre-group meetings about it. But I've also found that so many people, especially like veterans, they'll say, you know, I was so opposed to this, or I thought this was just a bunch of BS, and man, this is so great, and this has helped so much. And I just, them seeing is it more of like tools as opposed to like, you're weak and, you know, you can't handle it. But like, hey, I can learn new skills and I can learn new strategies, and that's all this is. and connecting, like just people saying, I want to reach out. I want to help other veterans. I want them to know about this. So try it out. You know, you might really find that it's enjoyable and beneficial and get some things off your chest and be validated for your suffering, whether it's really bad or not. A lot of people say, well, you know, other people have it worse. And that's such a disservice because it's apples to oranges. We don't know what their life's like. We have our own struggles. And, you know, unfortunately, access to mental health service isn't as easy and available as we'd like it to. I know getting in the VA is a really hard process and it takes a lot of time. But there are a lot of great services out there and there are a lot of great organizations and entities that want to help financially. So check them out. And there's a lot of great organizations out. There's one that I wanted to mention in addition to MAPS, and that's VET, Veterans for Entheogenic Therapy. And they are into some of those other treatments and using medicines like ayahuasca and ibogaine and psilocybin. And they are trying to raise money to help veterans and folks struggling. I mean, it's this organization obviously works with veterans, but they're trying to raise money to help veterans get help affording and paying for these treatments because they're not always cheap. Sorry about that tangent.
No, it's fascinating. Yeah. The current climate of our great country, there's a lot of talk about trauma and sexual assault. Mm-hmm. And it's a very kind of unsettling and uncomfortable time. And you doing your work with trauma, what can you tell us about the blah? I don't even know how to categorize it. It's just like a big blah to me.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting hearing how you describe it. It's like so different for... It's intense. It's very in our face. And in some ways, I'm not ever glad to hear about like the suffering of people, but I do hope that this does bring greater awareness, although it's in many ways not being treated very well and being, again, a lot of victim blaming. And unfortunately, leaders of our country are not handling very well what survivors go through. And it's even kind of being ignored or minimized or invalidated or disqualified what you went through. Oh, you know, sorry about your trauma, but we're moving on and we're actually not even really going to acknowledge it in some ways. So it's tough. There's so many hard things about it, but I say balance is really important. People who've gone through trauma and when things like this are triggering, which they really are, to hear about people's detailed accounts or to be reminded, oh yeah, that did happen to me. Even just like, you know, talking to my wife and hearing like, you know, you make these decisions in your head, like, well, it wasn't that bad. So, you know, this, I didn't get raped, so I'm good. And no, there's so many things, there's such a large spectrum of ways we can be harmed by other people. And the, again, the stats, we know that 1 in 4 girls and women, and probably 1 in 3 have gone through something like this. So there's so many people out there whose lives are being touched in rough, difficult ways. And so balancing the amount of time you listen to or watch the news, you know yourself best, trust your intuition. If you feel like you've had enough, turn it off, do something else, definitely get help. The statistics of people who called into RAIN, I think it's the Rape and Incest Network, 143% increase of calls the day of the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing. That's shocking. That's like unprecedented. And so with these events going on, it's just being brought out more and more and people are re-experiencing their own traumas. And so to take care of yourself, do a lot of self-care, talk to people that you trust. I'm glad that it's opening up dialogue. There's been things on the news about fathers and, you know, why haven't people told their fathers and all the reasons why, but just this dialogue and for men and fathers and mothers and family members and friends to just be talking about this and to hear and believe and trust survivors. I hope that it does increase the people who do reach out for help, the rape crisis centers, the campus resources. I work across the hall from our sexual violence advocate and educator, and you know, the people who are attending the support groups and We have a Healing Hearts for survivors of sexual assault and rape. The numbers of people participating in those groups have increased, and the political dialogue is being discussed in these groups. It's great to see emails going out on our campus about, you know, recognizing what's going on and the services that are out there. And I, myself and another female psychologist at San Marcos, we're kind of the trauma specialist in our center. And so, yeah, I just hope that people reach out for help and know that it's there and are not afraid to tell people that they trust about what's going on. And that's really important, not to kind of keep it in the shadows. But the really sad part is that it's reinforced that you can bring it forth and then your life could be ruined, or, you know, you won't be believed, or you'll be, your life will be turned upside down by coming forward. I hope that continues to change with the Me Too movement and other things that are going on.
Well, that's a lot.
Yeah. I mean, we could talk about that for a whole podcast, but
yeah, I may hit you up on that later after see what kind of turns of events happen, because I fear that it's not over.
Definitely. Yeah. It'll be interesting to see what in the next few years, what all comes of this, and how hopefully better things are happening as far as treatment and people getting help for these things. At least I hope.
Mm-hmm. What's fascinating to me, and this is kind of a tangent, but maybe you can shine some psychological insight onto this, is when people on social media post their opinions or their support of a victim or a movement or something, and on their personal page, on their personal post, they have people that they know who are telling them that they're wrong and telling them why they are so wrong and impressing upon their own opinions on it. And I don't understand why people can't just let people enjoy things, or people can't let people have their own opinion. If you have a differing opinion than me, that's great, but why are you hijacking my own Facebook post about it and telling me that I'm wrong and discounting everything that I have to say? It's me. It's my story. It's my thoughts. Yeah. Screw you.
Yeah. No, I made the mistake of, I try to avoid reading, and there's a lot of research that show, I like social media, and I've used it and use it from time to time, but there's research that shows that it increases people's depression or low self-esteem. So there's research behind the impacts of social media, but around things like this, it's so rough because everyone's going to have their own opinions and thoughts, and they can be very polarized, but it is hard to see. And a lot of myths and inaccuracies are expressed in people's opinions about factual things. That's sad. It's going to happen. But yeah, it's hard when people are coming forward, and there are probably a lot of trauma survivors who are writing these things and then being invalidated and not believed or told they're wrong on social media. So I would say to a lot of people is avoid reading those if you can, or if you notice that they're starting to have an impact on you, you know, take a break. And I don't know how we'll ever get people to stop from expressing their opinions and, you know, fighting online and saying horrible things that are hurtful. I don't know when that will ever stop. And I think some people are out there just trying to stir the pot, or they don't care, or they can say whatever they want. So it's rough when that is kind of the current state of affairs, and it's pretty scary, and it can be harmful to be on there. So just for people to be aware that that is a possibility and a risk that you take by posting and reading the comments of other people. Yeah, we're telling college students to be aware of that all the time.
Yeah, it's such a different time too, because there was no Facebook when I was in high school, and I can't imagine how bad my bullying would have been, how worse it would have been if there was social media.
Oh yeah, I know. I agree. glad it's more current thing than back then, and I wonder about my kids what it's going to be like.
Me too. So I would like to hear a funny or entertaining story from you. Now that we've talked about all the hard stuff.
I was thinking about that, and that was a tough question because I don't have any like story that comes to mind. One thing I will say is like, I've really come to believe never say never is like my new motto in life, because as I told you, my professional trajectory, I never thought I could do this. I never thought I could do that or work with this or that. And I never thought I would live in San Diego. I didn't want to. I like hated San Diego. Now I live in San Diego. I think it's interesting in that regard. But around psychology, therapy, I use humor a lot in the work that I do. And I think it's refreshing. And of course, it has to be appropriate. And I really try to balance like when things are serious and significant and they're not a laughing matter, but there are times that we need humor. And some of my most enjoyable moments in therapy or in the work that I do is just laughing with a client or gaining a fresh perspective or taking a step back and saying, man, we just catastrophized so bad that we went from, if I fail this test, I'll be a bum on the street. You know, in the future, I have no hope. It's like, that's funny when you step back from it and look at it. And so that's an important part of the work that we do. And in the work that you and I do, I mean, gosh, if it's always rough and dark and trauma, that's a course for burnout. So I think having fun and, you know, entertainment when we can. There's a colleague that I had in grad school, and he always just helped me take a step back and say, yeah, I know everyone's anxious about this upcoming like huge exam, but like in the grand scheme of things, this is just a bunch of bullshit. Like this is just silly and ridiculous. And like, he just had a great, and he works at the VA. And I think the veterans that work with him are very fortunate. He's a great guy. And, but he just helped me see things in a different light. And, you know, we'd be mountain biking and we'd be talking about our profession and the state of affairs and wars and rough things, but we could laugh and we could have a good time and, you know, put things into perspective when we needed to. So he was great at doing that for me.
Yesterday, we decided to do a tally of how many things we found in the road at work. So, you know, we had 3 barbecues in different places on the freeway. We had a hand cart. There was a truck that spilled W-2s all over the road. Mm. So yesterday was a big day for things in the road. And, you know, working on a Saturday, we had to make it fun. So at one point, everybody was making tally marks and adding the things that the police officers found in the road that day.
Oh, that's great. No, that's so fun. We have to do that stuff. And I'm a pretty, like, I laugh a lot. And I just, if you ask my friends or wife or, you know, coworkers, I work hard and I'm serious, but I love to laugh and have a good time. And we got to do that to survive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How can we learn more about what you're doing at Cal State or any organizations that you're involved in?
I mean, Cal State's pretty straightforward. I work in student health and counseling services. I, you know, students there that want to come and see me, you can call me directly on our website or email me. We have walk-in appointments every day, but I'm definitely want to work with any trauma survivor of any kind. I am very passionate about working with the veteran and military affiliated folks on my campus, their dependents, people who are touched by military life in any way. Another exciting thing is expanded access. They want to, once the FDA gives approval, then they want to open up 100 sites throughout the US that can do this therapy. And I would put a lot of money on the fact that there will be a site here in San Diego, just because of the large veteran population, that can take advantage of those services. So within the next few years, if you can't get into one of these studies to be a part of the trial itself, there will be opportunities here within the next few years. You know, there's videos online. If you type in MDMA, the movie on YouTube, or MDMA and PTSD, there's some great videos with veterans who've gone through this treatment. You know, some of the organizations I mentioned, MAPS, VET, what else? If you just type in veterans treatment and psychedelics, I found this in Mexico. It's in Cancun because it's not legal in here in the US, but there's a place called Clear Sky Recovery where they offer Ibogaine treatment for addiction and substance abuse dependence. And so, and like I said, there's, whether it's Wounded Warriors or Semper Fi Foundation, there's different foundations that will help veterans get funding, and probably even law enforcement and first responders. I do want to say that some of these MAPS trials haven't just been veterans. It has been law enforcement and first responders and sexual assault and rape survivors as part of this trial. So it's not just veterans, but people who've experienced trauma in their line of work or through sexual trauma. Those are some of the organizations that come to mind right now.
Well, I am absolutely fascinated. I'm going to go see if I can find that book right now because I do have a long trip and a long plane ride. So it'll give me something to look at.
Yeah, that's great. Acid Test. There's also a book called Ecstasy, The Complete Guide. Julie Holland is an MD, and she writes all the nitty-gritty, all the details of what MDMA does to us, the risks, all the contraindications. It's an excellent book. I've read a lot of it. There's books on ayahuasca and ibogaine. There's a great, really fascinating book. It even talks about SEALs, Navy SEALs, called Stealing Fire. And it just talks about all these different ways we can achieve flow states or non-ordinary states of consciousness. And it talks about psychedelics and psychology and all these research things and different ways that people are, you know, improving themselves, self-actualizing and healing from trauma. So that's probably the best book I've read in the last 10, 15 years, Stealing Fire. Really fascinating book. Good audio book too.
I'm looking it up on Amazon right now.
It's I've told so many people to read it. It's really, really fascinating.
Well, great. Do you have any closing thoughts for us before we skedaddle?
No, Aaron, I just really appreciate the opportunity and love the work that you're doing. It's important to get the word out. And I hope people, view mental health and suicide in different ways. There's help out there. And there's a lot of really exciting new treatments that we've mentioned today. So I hope people do some research and find some new excitement in things that can be done out there to help us heal and get better.
Well, thank you so much, Ryan, for joining us. I really appreciate you taking the time out to hang out and talk about a whole bunch of different types of mental health topics. It was very enlightening for me, and I hope to learn more.
Thanks, Aaron. Thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time, and I hope this helps folks out there who are listening.
Thank you so much for taking the time to listen today, and I hope that you found something that really resonates with you. I can't wait to share even more. So please subscribe to the podcast, and you can find links to our resources in the description and at youroxygenmaskfirst.com.